All right, we're back live at PDC 09, Channel 9. Very special guest, Dr. Jeff Norris from NASA. Thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do.
I work at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and there I lead a team that develops tools that we use to control Mars rovers and other kinds of spacecraft.
Amazing. And why are you at PDC?
Good question. We're announcing several things, actually. First of all, NASA, like many organizations, is doing a lot of exciting experiments with the cloud, mm-hmm. and the cloud is a big topic here at PDC, so we wanted to be a part of that. Second, we announced an exciting new public outreach site called beamartian.jpl.nasa.gov. But perhaps what I'm most excited about is that we announced a programming competition called the Pathfinder Innovation Challenge. And actually, there's programming parts and there's non-programming parts, but it's really a fun way for people to get involved with NASA who've got coding skills.
Excellent. And that's all sort of part of, you guys are really reaching out to the community with other initiatives as well, right? The Galaxy Zoo, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
You know, one thing that's really exciting about the cloud and a lot of the other advances we've had recently is that it's possible to bring more people into the space exploration process really than we've ever been able to before. And really in a new way, too, so it's not just about learning about it, which is great, of course, but it's also about helping NASA to do this, you know, really exciting and challenging thing.
Absolutely. And one thing that you guys generate is a lot of data from various planets in our solar system.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, you know, and of course software is fundamental here because that's the only way you can analyze it, transport it. I mean, software is data, but let's talk about, let's take a picture on Mars or on a rover. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps we're orbiting Saturn or whatever. And you get data, and you have to send it back to Earth, let's say to JPL. Take us through what's going on here.
Right, yeah, and that's a fun story because it's unfortunately we don't have Wi-Fi on Mars yet, although, you know, maybe someday. So when the rovers, for instance, take an image, you know, early in the mission, the rovers would often communicate straight to Earth using an antenna called a high-gain antenna on the rovers that they could point straight at Earth. But unfortunately, that takes a lot of power, and so it's not the most efficient way for us to send data back from the rovers. The more common way nowadays is that the rover will send those images first up to an orbiting satellite around Mars.
Okay.
So we have several of those, but one common one that Spirit and Opportunity use is the Mars Odyssey orbiter. And then Mars Odyssey holds onto that data for a little while and then sends it back to Earth for us. One thing that's really important, though, is that can take a while. It takes between 3 and 22 minutes for data to get from Mars to Earth. So this is a long way from you know, being able to joystick the rovers, for instance. That data makes it down to Earth through a network of satellite dishes called the Deep Space Network, which Jet Propulsion Laboratory manages.
Nice.
And those are these huge dishes that you've seen in movies like Contact and things
that.
That bring that data down here, and then the story's not over yet because that's just gotten it to Earth, and now we have to process that data and prepare it for the scientists to work with and engineers like me to look at as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because it's right there that the Pathfinder Innovation Challenge is asking for some help, because once the data gets here and we process it, there's still a lot of data and a lot of interesting things that we could try to discover in that data. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, for instance, the scientists might want to try to find all the images that have you know, rover tracks in it, because there's actually some interesting science you can do with that.
Mm.
So part of the Pathfinder Innovation Challenge is asking people to help us find those features, either by writing smart programs or by writing games
absolutely.
That people can play to help find them.
Excellent. And, of course, just looking and providing that information as well.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So we have our first question from Tableteer. How is NASA using the cloud? There's actually two questions here. So let's start with that. How is NASA using the cloud?
Well, there's a lot of possibilities there. So there's a broad strategy that our OCIO is leading for JPL, and then Vivek Kundra, of course, made some announcements about how the government at large is using the cloud. At JPL, we're experimenting with the cloud as a platform for data processing. So when a lot of data comes down from a mission, it can take a while to process all of that data. And so rather than building up a huge server farm within JPL or within a NASA center to process that, it's really natural to be able to burst that into a cloud environment, because the data doesn't come down from most of these spacecrafts all the time.
Mm.
It comes down in a big pile. You need to do a lot of processing, and then actually we don't need the compute capacity until the data shows up the next time. So
yes.
It's actually an ideal application for the cloud.
So let's talk a little bit about that sort of, you mentioned the 3 to 22 minutes. It's kind of a fair range. What's going on there? Solar wind, strange objects? Could it be dark matter? Just kidding. What's going on?
Well, that's fun because, of course, Mars and Earth are in orbit around the sun.
Sure.
And so depending on where they are relative to each other, we actually have a relatively short distance or a very long distance. I believe at the longest it's around 440 million kilometers. I think I've got that right. When the Earth and Mars are on the opposite sides of the sun at their absolute furthest extent from each other. So that makes actually the communications challenge that much harder because,
sure.
You know, the amount of time it takes to ship data to Mars or back from Mars changes. And so we have to react to it in operations.
Excellent. Now speaking about data moving around, Crypto Argonaut, great name, man. What is the data rate between rovers and orbiters to Earth?
You're going to challenge me to remember numbers off the top of my head.
Uh-oh.
Here. So, okay. I happen to know that Spirit and Opportunity, the rovers, their maximum bandwidth to the orbiter is 256 kilobits per second, which that sounds pretty good, but the thing you got to remember is that that link is only on for a short period.
Okay.
So, basically, while the satellite is flying over the rover and they've scheduled a communications pass, which only occurs, a couple, three times a day, we burst up as much data as we can during that period. But still, we're talking about a modest amount of data that we can get down each day from Mars. And so we really have to make the most out of every bit that we get.
Absolutely. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges, right? I mean, because we're talking about communicating with things that are so far away. From a software, from an engineering perspective, let's talk a little bit about that.
Right. So, it's tempting to think that we could just, hook up an Xbox controller to the rovers and
joystick
them
nice?
Around. Yeah. It would be great, actually. But because they're so far away, we can't directly control them in that way because it takes, as I said before, between 3 and 22 minutes for a signal to get there. So the round trip time is twice that. So imagine you're trying to play a game like Halo or something and you push your joystick forward, but your character doesn't move, or at least you don't see your character move for many minutes later. So it takes you out of that mode. It's much more like building up a long list of things that you want the rover to accomplish over the next few days. And really for our deep space missions, for instance, like the Cassini-Saturnian orbiter, we're even planning on the course of weeks, not days.
Mm.
So we think very carefully about what we want the spacecraft or the rover to do, stack up a lot of things, and then send that all up to the spacecraft, and then it executes those things over a period while we wait for the data.
Interesting. So let me see if I heard this right. So in some sense, you package up a bunch of commands, send it to an orbiter in the case of dealing with the rovers. They then send it down? Do you do sort of like pre?
It depends.
Okay.
So we can command the rovers via Odyssey.
Yeah.
But quite often we send the commands directly to the vehicle. So receiving that information on the vehicle isn't so power intensive as transmitting data back to Earth. So typically that's a direct transmission. In the case of the rovers.
Excellent. So we have another question from Ronnie Swafford. Any chance of a program like Folding at Home to use private computers to process data for NASA via the cloud?
I think that's a great question, and it's something that's really interesting to me, and it gets me really excited because, again, I feel like space exploration is not just something that NASA does, it's something that we're all doing, all of this country is exploring space with NASA. And so involving them in ways like this, and so what the question is referring to is Folding at Home, which is a program that you can run on your computer to help process protein folding data sets in order to help researchers discover cures for diseases. I think it's a great idea for NASA. And so the Pathfinder Innovation Challenge is exactly where that is going.
Mm.
We're actually asking people to help us write the programs that we then could distribute into the cloud or into public computers the way Folding at Home does it. And those programs help analyze these images for these hard-to-find but very interesting, very scientifically useful things.
Excellent.
So yeah, that's a great question. I like that.
Awesome. And we have another one from Judah Gabriel. Does NASA use unit tests to ensure quality in their software?
Absolutely. So continuous integration, unit testing are hallmarks of the work in my team and many other teams.
I mean, it's actually a fantastic point because, I mean, to fix bugs is going to take, like you said, 3 to 22 minutes to get the package back up there. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the reliability that you have to build up front in your software.
Well, absolutely. As you just mentioned, NASA has to worry a lot about making sure that the software we put on board our spacecraft and the software that we use to control the spacecraft is reliable. And so part of that, of course, is things like testing, and part of it is fault tolerance and making sure that when we do make a mistake, because hey, everybody makes mistakes, mm-hmm. that the spacecraft is able to react and control the situation, enter a safe state such that we can have the time to figure out how to correct the problem.
Sure. Now, given that it's in space, and in the case of Mars, of course, there's very little atmosphere. It's getting bombarded by radiation.
Mm-hmm.
How does that impact the execution of electrons running through a computer?
Right. Yeah. So we have these events called single event upsets, which gamma radiation and other kinds of radiation are impacting our spacecraft all the time. And Mars is better than some places, but when that radiation hits just the wrong thing on a spacecraft, it will cause erroneous bits to go through the processor, and that puts the spacecraft into a state where it protects itself. That's that safe mode that I was referring to before. So this pretty much happens to almost every spacecraft we have sometimes. Mm. It's not a serious event. It's something that the spacecrafts are designed to deal with.
Excellent. And so Bluefish 200 is asking, how long is the communication time to the last planet in our solar system? Is it possible to control a rover over this distance?
Wow, I don't think I can quote a lag time for the last planet in the solar system. It would be measured in hours, but it's certainly possible to still control a rover over that distance.
Mm.
Again, it's about telling the rover a lot of things that you need it to do instead of trying to tell it just the very next thing to do. So you can tell a rover, here is a week of things that I want you to accomplish, and trust the rover to be smart enough to keep itself safe, to do what you've asked it to do, and then if it has a problem or something, to just wait until you can check in it again. And so certainly,
sure.
A rover in an outer planet is certainly a possibility.
I mean, and that actually brings up a really good point. I mean, in some sense, what's the limitation for the size of the command package, right? I mean, if you give it a week, give it a month, give it 6 months, I mean,
right.
Let's talk about that.
If you tell, one way to think about it is if you, gave a very long list of instructions to a child and said, go do all of these things. If you make the list too long, there's a good chance that they're going to get about halfway through it and say, I don't really know what to do now,
okay.
And then wait for a while. It's a trade-off between how much do you want the vehicle to do on its own, meaning that you can let it go and do its thing, and how often you want to be able to check in and sort of redirect it and say, what have you seen so far? And now I've got a better idea based on what you just saw. We call that in our business tactical operations. So with the rovers, we want to have that loop be very tight, so only on the order of a couple of days or so, such that we see what's happening and can tell it, okay, based on what we just learned, we want you to do something a little different now than maybe we would have thought before we saw that data.
Amazing. And so, as you can imagine, someone actually alluded to in the questions, the complexity of testing for you guys, right? I mean, you can't sort of duplicate the reality of the situation. I mean, this is like a million miles away or whatever, going through space. How do you actually orchestrate testing?
Well, that's a good question. We try, of course, to duplicate the conditions that we'll find in space as well as we can. So there are different ways of doing that. At JPL, we have facilities that simulate the vacuum of space and the temperatures of space and the shocks and the vibrations that a spacecraft is going to encounter during something traumatic like entry, descent, and landing on another planet. There are also software simulations, of course, where we do our best to replicate in software what are the conditions going to be like on another planet. But as you've alluded to, we can't do that perfectly. Another really neat example that you can see on the Mars program's website is we've constructed the terrain around the Spirit rover, but we're currently trying to get ourselves extricated as accurately as we can, and then we're trying different ways of taking the rover out of that environment in order to do a better job on Mars.
Sure. And you guys are going to be sending up another rover.
Absolutely.
Which is essentially a lab.
Right.
In a much more complex lab than we have now.
That's the Mars Science Laboratory rover, which launches in 2011. Really neat spacecraft because, you know, I love Spirit and Opportunity. They're fantastic vehicles. But, you know, the years since that that mission launched, we've learned some things. And one thing I think that's really exciting about the next rover is that it has an incredible amount of scientific instruments packed inside of it. So the name Mars Science Laboratory is really quite apt because inside the vehicle, for instance, we have a mass spectrometer, a gas chromatograph, a tunable laser spectrometer, which basically means that a scientist can use this stuff to figure out pretty much what anything is that we find on Mars. It's really quite cool.
It's amazing. And back to questions. Thank you, guys and girls. Jeff Norris, how important is visualization, I'm assuming data visualization, to your work, and where do you see it going?
It's critical. So when we are tasked with the problem of controlling a vehicle on the surface of another planet or controlling an orbiter around a distant planet, the first challenge really is making sure that the operator has awareness of the environment around the vehicle. And one way we need to do that is to immerse the operator in imagery, in three-dimensional models, things like that, such that they get this intuitive feeling for the situation of the spacecraft. Of course, we also have to give them a feeling for the situation inside the spacecraft.
Yes.
Is it healthy? So it's sort of, you know, how do I feel and what's going on around me, things that are very natural for us as human beings, but more challenging when we are doing it over interplanetary distances. And visualization is absolutely key for that. It's a major part of the challenge.
Excellent. And Colonizer is asking, on a lighter note, have you seen the TV show Defying Gravity, and when do you think we can fully explore the solar system?
I have seen it, and you know, it's not going to be terribly surprising considering who I work for that I want to explore the whole solar system right now.
Of course.
It's a very exciting journey, I think, that we're on. I think there's a lot of exciting things in the the NASA program right now about potential returns to the moon and outer planet missions and new returns to Mars that I think are putting us on a great course towards those really exciting visions that we see in science fiction.
Excellent. And so Perfect Phase is asking, do the rovers have any autonomous guidance ability?
Absolutely. So the rovers are actually pretty smart when it comes to robots. They, for instance, the rovers can autonomously navigate over pretty long distances. So we can tell it, we just want you to go to this point out in the distance and do your best to get there, but on the way, stay safe. And so the rovers avoid obstacles, drive around rocks, things like that. We have some more advanced capabilities that have been uplinked to the rovers since they got there. So this is kind of a software update to Mars that let them do things like watch for dust devils on Mars, which are fairly rare, but very cool and scientifically interesting. So the rovers are capable of sort of staring out in the distance where we think that some dust devils might occur, and when they happen, taking that image and sending it back to us, rather than them having to send lots of images down that we then have to look through to try to find the dust devils.
Certainly.
So yeah, not only are they pretty smart, but they're getting smarter because people are writing more software for them even while they're operating.
Amazing, which brings beautiful segue into the next question in terms of, I mean, because it's software, I mean, you can evolve that, make the software smarter, you could add a lot of new capability without having to actually get your hands on the thing. So you guys really have a system that's very pluggable, very evolvable, right?
Absolutely, both on board and on the ground.
Yes.
Some of these missions can last a really long time, even decades for some of the big orbiters out towards Saturn and things like that.
Certainly.
So you can't just write the software that you know you're going to need today. You need to be planning for the things you're going to discover between now and when you get there, or even while you are there. So those capabilities I was just listing are great examples of challenges that we really didn't discover until we got to Mars, and we realized, hey, it would be awesome if the rover could do this. And then, you know, sure enough, you know, the developers at places like JPL put mm-hmm. together that capability and shipped it up to the rover. On the ground, we've made you know, continual advances in the ground system. That's the tools we use to monitor the rovers and control them. There, what we've had to do is learn, you know, for an extended mission, a mission that's lasting longer than we originally expected, how to do it less expensively, because we want to, you know, be as efficient as we can. So we're evolving the software to make it less expensive. We're evolving the software to make it so that more people from more places on Earth can participate in it as well. So that
Excellent.
Stuff goes on, and we do plan for it from the beginning.
Perfect. So Tabletier is asking, how does the rover navigate on Mars? There's no GPS or addresses, right?
Right, yeah. No Mars mapping website that we can ask for directions from, you know, one crater to another. No, there's no GPS, and that's a big challenge for the navigation of the vehicles, because they don't ever know exactly where they are. They can measure their relative motion via a variety of means. One thing they can do is just to count how many times their wheels turn, and we call that just wheel odometry. Another thing they can do is visual odometry, where as they're driving along, they watch for objects in the environment, and when they see them, they track them in order to get a feeling for how far they've driven. Mm. That's really important, because the wheel odometry can be misleading. The wheels spin sometimes in the soft sand, and so just that alone wouldn't tell you very well where you were going. So by a combination of things like odometry and visual odometry, we get a good feeling for where the rover has gone. And then on top of that, we take data that the rover has acquired, and we mesh it with other data that it's acquired to accurately localize the rover relative to its last position. And we build up a long chain of these positions, and that's how we produce the final data set of where is the rover and where has it been.
That's amazing.
It's fun stuff.
Absolutely. So just talk a little bit about you. I mean, what's your story in terms of, you know, when did you fall in love with space? And I mean, when did you decide this is what you wanted to be?
Thanks for that question. So it's always been something that I have been excited about. I think, like many children, I you know, wanted to be an astronaut when I grew up. As I learned more about all the different parts of the challenge of space exploration, I found what my niche was going to be in that challenge, which was in software and in robotics. So I went to school at MIT, and while I was there, I had the good fortune of taking a summer job with a company that was doing a contract with JPL, mm-hmm. and through that learned about this amazing place, the kind of work that is done there, and just knew that that was where I had to go. When I first joined JPL, which is about 10 years ago, you know, I hadn't lived in one place for that many years before, and, you know, college certainly I'd bumped around, you know, living in different places. So I think I thought of it as sort of a temporary thing, but I tell you, the longer that I've been there, the more it doesn't feel temporary. I really love being there.
Absolutely. I mean, JPL is an incredible place. I was lucky enough to visit there last year.
Oh, great.
So the Z-Duck, what programming languages are used to program the rovers and orbiters? C, C++, C#? Wow, yeah, you guys are running the CLR up there, huh? No.
So,
that's a good question.
Yeah, it's a very good question. So onboard Spirit and Opportunity, it's primarily C running in a real-time operating system. And there's a little bit of C++ that manages some of the more advanced capabilities of the vehicle. That's pretty much the state of where we are on onboard software.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there were spacecraft that predated C, but nowadays that's where we are with onboard software. On the ground, there's a broad variety of things. So in the tools that we're using to analyze the states of the spacecraft, there's more C, more C++, there's a lot of Java, there's web applications, there's, you know, the whole mix of things. Python, scripting languages.
Sure.
You know, it all kind of has to come together.
Now, in some sense, I mean, do you guys work on writing just DSL type languages? I mean, your own languages that, I mean, clearly specific to your domain, mm-hmm. could be useful if it was a language you guys create. Do you have
the most important domain specific language that we have is, of course, the language of the rovers, or the language of a spacecraft. So
yeah.
All of the spacecraft have a language that they want to be talked to in, and that
yes.
gives them the instructions about, you know, where are they going to drive, or where are they going to fly, what kinds of pictures are they going to take, and when. And there's been, you know, a lot of thought put into what should that language be like? You know, what kinds of features can it have to protect the spacecraft? Things like that. So certainly that fits the definition of a domain-specific language to a T.
Excellent. EXOS, whatever the name is, sorry. How about autonomous exploration? Are you working towards sending swarms of small robot explorers to Mars and elsewhere?
It's a really exciting idea. Obviously there are some advantages you get about taking lots of small vehicles someplace mm-hmm. rather than one large one. Interesting that there's also plenty of advantages of one large vehicle. So the next rover mission, for instance, is the rover is much larger
sure.
than Spirit and Opportunity. So some of the advantages it gets is just the advantage you get from a great big truck. It can drive mm-hmm. over big rocks, across gullies, things like that. It can move faster than the current vehicles. The many individual robots or the swarm robot idea, I think we'll see more of that when we can address the challenges of making a robot work in space to the point that it becomes kind of easy. And so then it's not so hard to have a lot of them. Right now, every one of those systems would have to control its temperature, has to have its own comm system, its own power management, and that's fairly complicated. And so replicating that many times so far hasn't proven to be worth the benefit to
sure.
go that direction.
Absolutely.
Hopefully someday.
So one final question here from Ronnie Swofford again. Any chance for a rover SDK allowing developers to write programs for a simulated rover?
Well, there's a couple things I could point out there. First of all, JPL has open sourced a rover technology SDK called Clarity that you can find online. I would also use this as an opportunity to refer back to the Pathfinder Innovation Challenge again, because there we're going to be, as part of that challenge, releasing details that people can use to write these data analysis programs. Not quite an SDK in that we're not releasing a whole bunch of code to them, mm. but we're partly because we're trying to build up that code base for the public and as well as for us to build on top of. So there, I think we're trying to develop something of an SDK.
Excellent. So the robotics, Microsoft Robotics Kit?
Sure. Well, Microsoft Robotics Studio, I guess, is what they're referring to. Not sure what the question was, but certainly.
Me neither. That was a weird one. Larry Law, what's going on?
Microsoft, it's an interesting technology development environment mm-hmm. for hobbyist robotics systems, and so I think it's a great place where people who are just kind of getting interested in the idea of, you know, maybe writing a program that would run on a little autonomous vehicle, it's a fun place to start. I'd recommend they check that out.
Excellent. Well, hey, it's great to talk to you. Great to meet you.
My pleasure.
Right on. So keep looking up.
Thank
right
you.
On.